Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, events, they're happening. There's a page for them. Go to that events page. You can look at the city events that are coming up. Houston and Las Vegas. Registration is free for both of those events. It's an all-day thing. Bunch of speakers. There's lunch. There is Q&A. You should come hang out. That's the big thing. You get to hang out with a bunch of folks. I'll be over there at both of those events. Chad will be with me in Houston.
Yeah, sir, right down the road.
Yeah. Eric Sorensen of 30 Minute fame will be over there in Las Vegas. You can get all the details on the events page. We would love to see you. We do ask that you sign up. I mean, you don't have to. You could just show up, but helps us know how many people are coming. So do that. Chad, what's going on?
Turkey's in the fridge.
Turkey's in the fridge?
Yeah. I don't know when people are going to listen to this, but I guess it'll come out, Thursday or Friday?
Yeah, so it'll be the day. It'll probably come out the day after Turkey's in the Belly.
Yeah, the day that everybody just sitting around completely lazy because they ate too much the day before.
People are going to listen to this on Black Friday. They're going to be out shopping, and we're going to be talking about some Northern Conquest.
Yeah. Well, they won't have to worry about me sharing any space with them on Black Friday shopping.
You don't do that?
No, I do not. I'm a Cyber Monday guy.
Oh, yeah.
I like to, sit in my recliner, get my laptop, shop. Yeah. I don't have to worry about getting a parking space or getting mobbed by, some crazy crowd somewhere. I can just surf my way through Amazon. What I want.
Last year might have been the first year where I'm not sure I bought one Christmas gift in a store.
Yeah.
Some ways I feel bad about. I feel like there's other people who have jobs and stuff and need to support those jobs. Yeah. I should probably go shop local somewhere, support some small business or something. But man, everything I need to do in that regard, I can just, Amazon is, I'm that guy. When Christmas rolls around, the UPS truck is coming to my house, dropping off the stuff that I ordered.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, every day we get home, there's a package, two packages,
mm-hmm.
whatever it is. That's my kind of shopping.
Now, does your wife like to go, though? Does she want to go out?
Yeah, more so than I do.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never been much of a shopper. It's just, I am not good at buying gifts. If somebody tells me exactly what they want, I'm happy to get it. But I've never been good at just finding stuff for people. Some people just have that gift. They just always find the right thing for you. But that's not been me. But yeah, Stacy, she shops. I mean, she does a lot of online stuff, but she doesn't mind going out and, going
to the stores. Yeah, hitting that Starbucks and just toting around a coffee and just window shopping and going around these stores and stuff. It's not my favorite, but...
Yeah, not mine either.
But I do have a daughter who loves to do that with her mother. So I usually just stay home and watch sports when that's going on.
Ah, there you go. Yeah,
this is all so very cliche, isn't it? The wife and the daughter shopping and I'm watching football. And, geez.
Yeah, well, that's why we have cliches, because they're so rooted in reality.
Yeah, right? Indeed. Yeah. Well, what's going on in this conquest of Canaan?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. All this has a lot to do with Joshua, I guess, in some way. So, yeah, we're for those of you who listened last time, I hope you did. If you didn't, go back and check out that episode. But we covered chapter 10 of Joshua, and we crossed the line a little bit into Joshua chapter 11 because we had a few minutes left. We talked about the next area of conquest, which is the northern campaign. So we entered kind of central Canaan, took out Jericho, Ai, the Gibeonites, they surrender. So all that kind of area is taken care of. And then we moved south. That was Joshua chapter 10. But we had this whole area in the north. So we're going to have the northern campaign now. And we start out here kind of like we did at the beginning of chapter 10. If you remember the beginning of chapter 10, you have Adonizedek, who's the king of Jerusalem. He gathers together a cohort of other kings, and together they go against Joshua and the Israelites, and of course they get beaten. Well, the same thing's going to happen here, except it's in the northern part of Canaan, because you have a king by the name of Jabin, or Yavin, however you want to say his name, J-A-B-I-N, and he's the king of this metropolis named Hazor. which is north of the Sea of Galilee. And as I talked about last time, is a big place, lot more acreage than your typical city in Canaan at this particular time. So, and with the archaeological levels that they've dug going way back to you know, a millennium before Joshua and the Israelites got there. So an old city, a big city, and a powerful city. It was a leading city of this particular area. So the king of Hazor gathers together, again, a cohort of kings who have this similar enemy in Joshua and the Israelites. So anyway, the first four verses kind of just describe this coalition of forces that are going to go against this new kid on the block, these Israelites who have just been stomping everyone that they've encountered. Now, I'll pick it up here with verse 4, and we'll see what happens. I have an interesting phrase that occurs in verse 4. See if you can, if you're listening, see if you can, if it resonates with something you've heard before. And they came out, that is all these, this coalition against the Israelites. They came out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that's on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. All right, so you picked up the phrase, right? It's the metaphor or the simile, as many as the sand on the seashore. So I think, I could be wrong, but I think this is the third time that particular image is used in the Bible. The first two are in Genesis. There's the first one's in Genesis chapter 22, which is, of course, the near sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham. And it's in Genesis 22 where God promises Abraham he's going to have descendants, as many as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. The same promise and same image is repeated in Genesis chapter 32 to Jacob. And now we hear it once more, but in a very different kind of context in Joshua chapter 11, because now, in kind of an ironic sort of way, it's used not to describe the population of Israel in fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham, but it's used to describe the enemies of Israel that have gathered together to try and defeat and kill the descendants of Abraham. So I think that's what's, I mean, it's kind of, I think that's what's going on here. The reason that the author chose this particular image, this particular metaphor, because it's used in sort of an ironic sort of way. So here's Israel that has grown in number and power over the generations. They're now entering into the land that God promised to give to Abraham. And yet, even now that they're here, they still face a foe that, like they are, is as numerous as the sand that's on the seashore. But the irony, of course, is that no matter how many there are, no matter how powerful they are, no matter what kind of superior weaponry they have, they're no match for the one who stands behind the Israelites to fight for them, namely Yahweh.
Yeah, this great many of horses and chariots language is very Egypt-like, is it not?
Yeah. In fact, I'm glad you pointed that out, because we're gonna see in the next few verses how I'm convinced that this is written with Egypt in mind. And specifically, not just Egypt in mind, but specifically with what happened in Exodus 14 at the Red Sea. I think what's happening here is the story is described in such a way that you can't, that if you know the Old Testament, if you know the story, that you can't read this particular story without understanding how it is flowing from these earlier stories. And I think the sand on the seashore is just kind of the beginning of that. Because, of course, when have we heard about horses and chariots before? Well, of course, that's what the Egyptians had, right? That's what they were on when they went out to try and bring the Israelites back after they had left Egypt after the 10th plague.
Yeah, I mean, this is in the Israel hymnody, right? I mean, this is horse and the rider thrown into the sea kind of stuff. I mean, if you're Israel, exactly horse right. And rider, that's not unfamiliar language to you.
Yeah, I mean, that was Song of Moses. They knew this. And so just like, you know, certain phrases that we sing in popular hymns, we can't hear those without immediately, we can't hear those in another context without immediately linking it back to the hymn context, that's going to be the same for the Israelites.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons they sang it, was it so much became so much a part of them.
Yeah. And, you know, you might think, well, is there anything special about horses and chariots? Well, there is something special about it in the sense that not everyone is rolling around with chariots. Not everyone had like huge cavalries and a huge army of chariots and stuff. This actually is a fairly rare thing at that time.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have it. I don't remember when. I'd have to look at that. Maybe in the time of King David is when Israel finally had chariots. I don't know. I'd have to look back into that. But at this point, anyway, we know they don't have chariots. So they're already outmanned and outgunned, as it were, because this particular part of the Canaanite Confederation, they have these horses and chariots.
Yeah, I mean, and horses and chariots are a pretty big advantage. At that time, I mean, a chariot, if you have a ton of chariots, I mean, this makes things very difficult.
Yeah. I looked a little bit at this last week because I didn't know how far we would get, and I was talking about it with my wife afterward, just the history of chariots. And I mean, we've seen these in movies, but can you imagine what it would be like? It would take a lot of skill simply to be able to fight from a chariot.
Yeah.
I mean, you got two guys in there. You got one who's driving the chariot, basically. And then you got the other guy who is the archer. So, I mean, I've hunted a little bit with a bow, and I know it's a challenge, but I've never tried to hunt on the back of like a bouncing wagon, basically. That's being pulled by two horses in a rough field. I mean, this had to be an amazing skill that these guys had, not just to be able to shoot, but to shoot from a moving vehicle that was bumping along in the midst of a battle. I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Well, I mean, this has not much to do with this other than the similarity and the military advantage. But, you know, like when the Mongols took, like, just, I mean, almost took over the world. Mm-hmm. You know, the way they were able to do it is because they had they were people of the steppe, and what they had is they had these steppe riders, and they had these guys that could just one guy on the back of a horse, like running full blast, and they could shoot arrows like crazy off horseback. Like, so they would just like had really strong hips, I guess, and just clinging to this horse, and then just deadly accurate with a bow and arrow, and they just had a, you know, sheaf full of arrows, and they just tore people up, man. And nobody had ever seen anything like it, and they didn't know what to do about it.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a couple of books about their history. It just amazing military power. And yeah, I mean, they really did. They almost conquered. Well, they were kind of like Alexander the Great, and it's, you know, he conquered kind of the known world, and that's basically what they did.
They only didn't actually like conquer everything that was known because of weird political problems, like where like, oh, our guy died, we have to go all the way back to this place and find a new leader. If they weren't doing that junk when they were in their conquest, man, it'd have been over.
Yeah, I don't think there was probably an advance, a greater advance in kind of military weaponry or transportation until, in a few cases, they started using elephants in warfare. Mm-hmm. I mean, horses is one thing, but elephants is that's taken it to a whole other level. But I mean, if you're on foot and you're facing an army that is horseback, then your chances of winning just basically are nil. Yeah. Unless you've got God on your side.
Right, yeah, yeah. So you might think this has nothing to do with anything, but what we're trying to paint here is that if you have a whole bunch of people, but then they have military advantages that are no small thing. I mean, this is like fighting someone that's got tanks and you don't. And mm-hmm. this creates a problem for you.
Yeah. Yeah, but this kind of sets up, though, in a parable sort of way, I guess you could say, a theme that we see throughout scripture, though, right? I mean, God's people are constantly either outmanned or outgunned or outpowered, whatever it is. And yet, in many ways, well, yeah, some cases where God actually, he sets it up that way. I mean, he actually wants his people to be outmanned and outgunned in order that there might not be the slightest temptation for them to think that they were able to win the victory because of their own wisdom or their own planning or their own powers or whatever it might be. I mean, the classic example of that, of course, is Gideon, who has a lot of people. And God says, all right, you need to, anybody who's scared, tell them to go home. He says, okay. Anybody scared, go home. So a bunch of guys leave. And God's like, oh, no, no, there's still too many. Take them down there to the river and let them all get a drink. And the guys who, I can't remember which is it, the guys who lap the water like a dog, are they the ones that stay? Or is it the other guys? Whoever it is, it's like 300.
Yeah, I can't remember. It was.
I think the dog lappers are the 300. Either way,
you can read it. That seems right, because who does that?
Right. Yeah. So this was the first 300. These weren't the Trojans,
Spartans. Yeah.
Spartans. Yeah. These weren't the Spartans, but these were the Israelites. So anyway, God like purposely says, I want you to only have a few men in order that you might realize that I'm the one who gives you the victory. So God in some cases, even sets it up like that. But he certainly takes advantage of these situations. You got the David and Goliath kind of scenario that's played out over and over in Israel's history. And of course, this comes finally to Christ, who, I mean, one man against the whole, not just against the whole Roman system, but also against the Sanhedrin and the powers that were kind of latent within the religious powers that were latent within that. So one man against the world, as it were, and yet God gives him the victory through the resurrection. So all of these kind of big powers versus little bitty Israel was setting the stage for what happens in the crucifixion and resurrection. So anyway, they had horses and chariots. All that was the commentary on horses and chariots. So pick it up here with verse 5. What happens? Well, so all the kings, they agree to meet, and they come and they encamp together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. Now, I think this is another one of those cases, like you mentioned earlier, horses and chariots make you think of Song of Moses and Exodus 14. And I think the fact that they're camped by the water, and that's where the battle's going to take place, and God's going to give them the victory, this is another one of those resonances that takes us back to what happened with Israel when the Egyptians attacked them.
Yeah, just never fight Israel near water. Get them away from the water.
Yeah, it's a bad place to be. And listen to this. This is verse 6. This also is picking up the language of Exodus 14. This is God speaking to Joshua. He says, don't be afraid because of them. For tomorrow at this time, I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. Now listen to that. And let me turn here to Exodus 14, verse 13. And this is also going to be God's speech, except it's going to be God speaking through the mouth of Moses. So in verse 6, God says, don't be afraid, for tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. And then in Exodus 14, 13, Moses says, don't be afraid. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. So what Moses says to Israel, basically, don't be afraid. These guys that you see before you today are going to be wiped out by the time tomorrow comes. Same thing that the Lord says to Joshua in chapter 11. Don't be afraid, because tomorrow I'm going to deliver you into their hands. And you shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. I guess it's because I grew up with horses. I can't help but feel sorry for the horses. You know, I don't feel sorry for the enemies of Israel, but my heart kind of goes out to the poor horses who are going to be hamstring. I did look up how often this happened. This actually occurs more than once, this hamstringing of the animals of the enemy. David does it in 2 Samuel against some of his enemies. He hamstrings their horses. I don't know why they didn't just kill the horses. That doesn't make any sense to me. Maybe there was a reason, you know, because if you hamstring anything, if you cut that tendon,
then of course they're useless. They can't walk, so they're going to die anyway. I'm not sure why the animals weren't just put to death. But anyway, that it happens here. It happens later in David's wars. And we hear about it in Genesis 49 was the other place when Levi and his brother, they tricked the city of Shechem into all the guys getting circumcised, and they go in and slaughter everybody. In Genesis 49, when Jacob blesses his 12, his sons, he says that not only did they go in and slaughter the inhabitants, but they also hamstrung their oxen. So that's the first reference to doing this to the animals of an enemy. Maybe this was part of ancient warfare. Anyway, they do it here. And of course, they're going to burn the chariots too. So the God, this is what God says. So what's going to happen? Well, verse 7 says, Joshua and all the men of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel so that they defeated them and pursued them as far as Great Sidon and Mizrephoth-Mayim and the valley of Mizpah to the east. And they struck them until no survivor was left to them. And Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung the horses and burned their chariots with fire. Then Joshua turned back. He captured Hazor and struck its king with the sword. For Hazor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms. I mentioned before that they were the leader of all of these city-states. They struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was no one left to breathe, and he burned Hazor with fire. Interestingly, archaeologists who have excavated the city of Hazor found a couple of burn layers, one much later than this time, but one that aligns pretty close to when the time of Joshua would have been. So good chance that archaeologically we have evidence that that was the particular destruction of the city that took place. And of course, as we've discussed a couple different times, in the old days when cities were destroyed, well, another city would just be built on top of it. And that's why you have these tells, these mounds that are littered throughout the land of the East, because this is just a long, long time place of habitation. Anytime there's a destruction, well, you don't have bulldozers. You don't go in and like level out everything. You just build on top of the ruins. And after a while, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger until you have this big mound. So that's what happened with the city of Hazor. Then it goes on, verse 12, Joshua captured all the cities of these kings, all their kings, and he struck them with the edge of the sword, utterly destroyed them. All this language of utterly destroy in your English translations is the Hebrew cherem that we have seen repeatedly, this putting things under the divine ban. So anytime you see something like utterly destroyed, know that the Hebrew behind that is cherem.
Yeah, you'll see that that translated as devote to destruction a lot of times.
Oh, yeah, that's another. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that translation. Yeah, devote to destruction, utterly destroyed are typical renderings of putting something under the ban, putting it to cherem.
Yeah, it makes sense that you would translate it that way, but it's a weird thing. We could think about devoting something to something else. It's weird. Destruction is not a word that we would typically combine with, you know.
Yeah, I'm very devoted to destruction.
Yeah, it's a little weird. But you know, when you talk about devoting something, I mean, this is where we get the word devotion. It's interesting that in one sense it could be very disturbing because you're like, I don't know, man, like devoting things to destruction doesn't sound very good. But what if you're looking at this and what it's pointing to as this, the enemies of Israel, the enemies of God's people, if you look at God's judgment, which is of course what we talked about over and over again, what all of this talks about, to devote, there's something built into that phrase that would mean a complete, I mean, that you says you have utterly destroyed, but this devotion like has a more spiritual connotation to it, right?
Yeah, because it's not just like we're going to wipe these guys out. We don't like them,
right?
But this is the implementation of a divine decree, basically. So this is all God's doing. that this particular judgment and destruction.
And as off-putting as it is, the reason it's so complete, it's so utter, it's destruction to the uttermost, is because, again, when we're talking about the wrath of God, this is what we're talking about. I mean, so he is using this as a picture of what happens when the judgment of God falls on a people.
Yeah, all these are pictures of, in one way or another, of two things. They're all pictures of the crucifixion, and they're all pictures of the end time, right? And the crucifixion and the last day are kind of two sides of the same coin. Because in many ways, the last day's already occurred. It happened when Christ was crucified. That's why you have all these kind of weird end time events happening, like earthquakes and sky darkening and people coming out of their tombs, all that kind of stuff happening when Christ dies. Because in many ways, that was already the last day. But of course, there's also the last day coming, in which all these things are going to happen again. But both of those events, the crucifixion and the last day, are pictured for us in all these Old Testament kind of stories like this. So you read them eschatologically. That is to say, you read them from the end to the beginning. So when you're reading these stories, you put the last day in mind as you're reading these stories of destruction.
Yeah, and this is very much how God is. I mean, if you think about his, God's threat to Moses, his threat to Moses is, how about I utterly destroy this people and start over with you? He doesn't talk about, leaving Moses, a little posse of good people or something like that. When God decides that he's done with something, that he's done with it. And so when he says to Moses, knows this, he's like, if God decides he's done with this, it's going to be over.
Yeah, it's all or nothing. Yeah, so that, I mean, it's this is one more case of those many examples like that. Speaking of Moses, he comes up here in verse 15. It says that just as the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. So we have this common theme in Joshua: as Moses, so Joshua. So Moses serves as a foreshadowing of Joshua, just like Joshua serves as a foreshadowing of Jesus. You have multiple examples of this kind of string of types or string of foreshadowings in the Old Testament, because like Adam was a whole lot like Noah, and then Noah is a whole lot like Christ, and you have Moses, who's a lot like Joshua. Moses also is very similar to Samuel. There's even some affinities between Moses and Gideon. So you have this kind of domino effect, I guess you could call it, where one person falls into another, who falls into another, each one of these being similar to the one that came before them, and it all is leading to the fulfillment, the anti-type that comes in the Messiah. So as Moses, so Joshua. Now, verse 16 through 23, to wrap up this chapter, is a summation of kind of everything that has gone before, and in many ways, a looking forward to what is going to be coming after. So I'll begin here with verse 16. It says, Joshua took all that land. And then we have a list of what this land is. So the hill country and all the Negev and all the land of Goshen, the lowland, the Arabah, the hill country of Israel and its lowland from Mount Halak that rises towards Seir, even as far as Baal God in the valley of Lebanon at the foot of Mount Hermon. You get your atlas out, your map, to find all these places if you're interested. He captured all their kings and struck them down and put them to death. Now, we have an interesting verse here, verse 18. Joshua waged war a long time with all these kings. So the Hebrew there is, I think, Ravim, whatever it is. It's many, many days. Now, how long has happened? Probably about 7 years. We'll get to it when we get to chapter 14, but we have the age of Caleb, when they spied out the Holy Land, and then we have a later age given of Caleb, and the way it kind of lines up, it looks like it was pretty intense warfare for about 7 years. Now, I say that because we kind of get the impression looking at just the chapters we've covered these last few episodes, that all this was just like blitzkrieg. You know, just they went in, body slammed everybody, took the land within like 6 months.
Yeah, it didn't happen that way. Yeah, you read this and you're like, that sounds like a hell of a weekend.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, you gotta get that impression, right? Like, yeah, they went in, they took Jericho, and then it went south. They took those guys out, and they turned north, and they took all these cities out. And it just like it happened really fast. It didn't. It took many days, and those many days were probably pretty close to 7 years.
Well, so 7 years makes sense.
Of course, it's got to be 7 years. Yeah. It's in the Bible, so it can't be five or eight or six.
You're trying to tell me this thing was complete after 7 years? Shocking.
Yeah, very, very strange. So we'll hear more about that as we go along. But I think it's an interesting verse that's kind of thrown in there, just to kind of slow things down a little bit. It says, there was not a city which made peace with the sons of Israel, except the Hivites, living in Gibeon. Heard that story a couple episodes ago. Now, verse 20 is another one of these verses. We've already seen a couple of them. Here's another one of these that takes us back to Exodus again. We see once more how much Exodus has influenced this particular account. Verse 20, for it was of the Lord to harden their hearts, to meet Israel in battle, in order that he might utterly destroy them or devote them to destruction. That's that word again, that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So it's kind of a fascinating word thing going on here, because the verb for harden their hearts is chazak, and it is the verb that's used all over Exodus to describe how Pharaoh hardened his heart and how God hardened the heart of Pharaoh. It's used there. But what's interesting is it's the same verb that's used repeatedly in Joshua when Joshua is told, be strong and courageous. That verb for be strong is chazak, the same word that's used here for harden. So it's kind of an interesting wordplay, I guess, that's going on here. Because we've heard multiple times, of course, God says to Joshua, be strong and courageous. Don't be afraid. Be strong and courageous. So be strong, over and over, chazak. Now we get to verse 20, and we're told that the Lord also made strong the hearts of the enemies of Israel, but he made them strong in a very different sort of way. He made them strong in the sense that he hardened them so that they would basically go into battle against the Israelites and as a result be destroyed.
Well, it was a very
Pharaoh kind of activity.
I think it's fascinating that it talks about how no one pursued peace with them. Because if you just read the accounts, it seems like peace is not an option. Like Israel's just going to go in here and just wipe everyone out. But it says that no one pursued peace with them, that they might not receive mercy. In other words, if there were kingdoms that had come out and tried to make peace, this puts Israel in a weird spot, which we've already seen.
Yeah.
Where you assume that they would have to consider doing so, right? But what you also see time and time again is they'll roll up on a city and it'll say that city came out to meet mm-hmm. them. Like they're ready to go. And so one of the things you can, you know, because again, the conquest of Canaan is a little disturbing. One thing that is true in the text is that no one's asking not to fight or to have peace or to try diplomacy. That time and time again, Israel shows up, the troops come out, and you got a war on your hands. And so it's not as though like there's these kingdoms pleading for a negotiation to find a better way. This doesn't happen ever except for that one time. And the one time it does happen, that's what they get.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would logically, you would think that if you're a king in, say, the northern part of Canaan, and word has reached you that basically everybody else in that area has just been completely annihilated by Israel, my first thought would probably not be, oh, well, I'm going to go kill those guys. My first thought would probably be, what can I do to save my city? But that's not the way it works. Everybody, there are no doves here. They're all hawks. So everybody goes out to fight. No one pursues peace. And I think the reason is exactly what is said here in verse 20. The Lord had hardened their hearts. And this wasn't some sort of like just kind of flippant move. God woke up in a bad mood and decided, you know what? I'm going to harden the hearts of all these guys so they get destroyed. This was a long, long time in coming. If you remember, already in Genesis 15, when Abraham was around, God told him that the sins of the Amorites, meaning everybody that lived in Canaan, had not yet been fulfilled. Like they were still going to continue doing their thing for like 700 more years. So this was going on a long time in the land of Canaan. So that hardening took place not just over like a day or a week or a year, but over actually centuries of kind of this gradual unraveling of society until it became what it was when the Israelites entered.
Yeah, it's kind of important to remember that this isn't like a good guy versus bad guy thing. I mean, as God says, like, I'm going to give you Canaan, but it's not because of your righteousness, but because of their sin, which sounds weird because if you're like, okay, so those are the sinners and then these people are not the sinners. And he makes very clear, no. Those are the sinners. You're sinners too. You just happen to be marching around with my promises.
Right. Yeah, it's very important to keep in mind because we work with kind of a good guy, bad guy dichotomy all the time, right? I mean, that's the way it is in most movies and novels. And, you know, you got the guys who wear black hats and you got the guys who wear the white hats. You got the good guys and the bad guys. Well, that's not the way it works in the Bible. I mean, in one way or another, they're all bad guys. Just some bad guys have God's promises and his choosing of them to be his nation, his people, and some don't.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you should read the conquest of Canaan with the overlay of not because of your righteousness, but because of my name, which is just another way of saying you're going to take this over because these people are extremely wicked, but you're not going to win because you are not extremely wicked. You're going to win because of my name, which is just another way of saying because I gave you my promise and I will not lie.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. So let's wrap up the chapter. We just have two or three verses left. It says Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim. Those are the big people, the giants that we've read about before. He cut them off from the hill country. And then it goes on to describe the destruction of those cities. It says there was no Anakim left in the land of the sons of Israel, only in, now notice this, these are the giants, right? The only ones left were in Gaza, Gath, and in Ashdod, some remained. Now, the reason that's important is because Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod, those are the cities of the Philistines. And it's from the Philistines, of course, that Goliath and his brothers and his family are going to come. So there's a direct link between these Anakim we've heard about before, the big guys, the giants, and the giants that we are going to encounter much later, like in the books of Samuel, who are living down in those same areas. So verse 23 wraps it up. And verse 23 is sort of a summation of the whole book of Joshua in many ways. It says, Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance to Israel, according to their divisions by their tribes. Thus the land had rest from war. So the first part of that verse looks back to what's happened, and the second part of that verse looks forward to what we're about to come to. So we will be talking actually quite speedily about the next few sections, because the next few sections are going to talk about the division of the land and some of the related matters. So we will we'll probably be moving through the next few chapters at a pretty good clip. So put on your seatbelt for the episodes that are coming up.
All right. Well, Chad, since this episode is going to air right after Thanksgiving, it behooves me to say, if you are thankful for the work of 1517, not just this podcast, but everything else that 1517 does, we are rolling up on what is known as Giving Tuesday, and we do have a campaign for that. Now, Giving Tuesday is December 3rd. It is a day when people give to nonprofits and this sort of thing. It's interesting that it is near Thanksgiving, and the reason for that is, as people think about things that they're thankful for, sometimes they want to give back. And if that's you, We could use your help. We do have a goal of raising $100,000 on Giving Tuesday to support the work. What are you supporting? Well, we talked about it a little bit last week, but the podcast network, you're listening to a podcast right now. We have grown to 175,000 monthly downloads. So that's how many different people are downloading the podcast, the free online academy where people are getting theological and historical education. We have over 20,000 students. We have the blog that is reaching over 40,000 unique people per month. Those are just all the sort of free things that we do. I mean, we talked about the city events, which are always free. Obviously, none of this stuff is free to make. I mean, we try to produce very high quality content. We try to create content that's not difficult to look at or listen to. And the events, we try to make sure that they're a good time. All of that stuff is made possible by people chipping in. And so if you have benefited and are thankful and are able to join us in this campaign to reach this goal so we can reach even more people in 2020, I'll put a link in the show notes, but you can just go over to 1517.org/GivingTuesday and you can make a gift that will be designated to help us reach that goal and help us keep doing the things that we are doing. And so if you are able to do something that you can afford, but whatever you can afford is greatly appreciated.
Sounds great.
Chad's gonna do it. I'm gonna do it. We're all gonna do it. It's gonna be great. And we'll be back next week.
We'll see you then.